District of Conservation is sponsored by the Committee for a Constructive Tomorrow, better known as CFECT. To learn more about our sponsor, head over to CFECT.org. Thanks for listening to the program.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to District of Conservation. I am your host, Gabriella Hoffman. This podcast offers a sober examination into all things hunting, fishing, shooting sports, energy, environment, and the public policy surrounding it. And this podcast also specializes in original interviews that you won't hear elsewhere. Here's what I have for you today. Hope you're recovering from St. Patrick's Day well. It was a busy weekend. I also celebrated a birthday the day before St. Patrick's Day, so I'm excited. I feel refreshed and renewed. I'm a year older. I'm now officially a peak millennial in the prime of life, so I can't complain. And to those of you who wish me happy birthday, thank you very much. And I'm so excited this week. We have hit in this region in the DC metro area, peak cherry blossom bloom. Very exciting. For those of you with allergies, not the best time to be here, but it's going to be beautiful all around. The cherry blossom tree in my front yard is blooming, so at least I have that if I can't visit the tidal basin, but I'll try. I have plans to visit. But today I want to draw your attention a little outside the beltway because I think what our guest today on the program has to say has wide sweeping implications for those of us who live on the East Coast and also the West Coast and everywhere in between, flyover country, what have you. As we have often examined and explored here on the show, incremental bans to hunting. And this year, Colorado is taking center stage. That is why I've brought on Dan Gates from the Coloradans for Responsible Wildlife Management Group that you may have seen on social media. They've been drawing a lot of awareness to upcoming ballot initiatives in the Centennial State that would ban what is quote unquote so-called trophy hunting, not only just mountain lion and bobcat management, but there's even language if they are to successfully readopt it into an initiative, ballot initiative for the vote this fall, it would have implications for all forms of hunting. It is scary. A little background on Coloradans for Responsible Wildlife Management. Their mission is to enhance, promote, and defend the North American model of wildlife conservation and responsible wildlife management, focusing on the public's best interest for maintaining a century-old track record of our natural resources, including wildlife, habitat, fisheries, and working farms and ranches. Colorado's fight today could be your state's battle tomorrow. We have seen this creep all over, especially in what are known as blue states, which unsurprisingly have very anti-hunting commissioners and even governors in elected office who are influenced by anti-hunters and even anti-anglers. While what Dan might say is troubling, I think it is a timely message and perhaps it'll motivate you to get more involved in the fight, whether you are in Colorado or not. So I'll let Dan take it away from here. I would love to hear your feedback on this. It's a really good episode. Enjoy. Dan, thanks for joining the podcast. It's great to connect.
Thank you very much. Appreciate the opportunity and look forward to getting into some of the conservation conversations for the West.
We love having those here because as my listeners know, I am from the West. I call it the inferior West because California has kind of lost its luster when it comes to these kind of things. And my worry is that it could your state, Colorado, could follow in the footsteps of California. We don't want that to happen. And that's why I think individuals like you and your organizations are trying to stop the bleeding with respect to that. But you and your fellow bedfellows in Colorado have been really heightened to a lot of the efforts to reimagine wildlife management, conservation, incrementally ban so-called big game hunting or so-called trophy hunting. And I think it's important for listeners to know what's happening in Colorado. It may not be exclusive to Colorado, but it could also extend beyond Colorado's borders. And so what led you and others to start Coloradans for Responsible Wildlife Management?
Well, and thanks for the question, Gabby. We have dealt on this landscape for quite some time. I'm the executive director for the Coloradans for Responsible Wildlife Management. I'm also the president for the Colorado Trappers and Predator Hunters Association. And I sit on as I often mention, a wide variety of boards and committees, some appointed, some volunteer, some elected. And we started this organization back in 2016-17 with the ideology that we needed to do something to up our game from a regulatory, statutory representation relevance component in the Colorado General Assembly with the Colorado Parks and Wildlife Commission, knowing full well that we probably were going to have to deal with something inevitable like a ballot initiative. And we haven't had a ballot initiative to take anything away since 1996. That was Amendment 14 that changed the Colorado Constitution to take trapping away. And 4 years before that, we had Amendment or Initiative 90, or Initiative 10, which was in 1992, that took away spring bear hunting with hounds and baits, the baiting. And so the ballot initiative that came up in 2020 was actually to bring something in. And while we didn't play at that landscape at that point in time, when we formulated our efforts in 2017, we knew that we were probably going to deal with a different gubernatorial administration, different ideology, different methodology, and we didn't know it was going to be as bad as what it's become, but we figured that we better engage at a different level than most of the C3 and C6 organizations, the 501c3 organizations that we're all members of, and I mention this frequently. So we started a 501c4 because we saw the need for some sort of legitimate lobbying representation at the Colorado State Capitol, and also to be able to broaden our net, so to speak, to prepare for what we thought was would be the inevitable of an animal rights extremist mentality or agenda that has actually come to fruition in our state at a variety of different levels. And while we aren't as prepared as what we would like to be, we have been more prepared than others thought we would be. And this is a moving target for sure, but we're in it for the long haul, and we're just trying to make sure that we cross our T's and dot our I's and leave no stone unturned, trying to beat what we consider to be animal extremist, animal rights extremist, and also engage with our conservation partners to the point to where we are lockstep, arms locked, walking in the same direction and not going different directions, trying to see, you know, who can be picked off so easily.
Could you give kind of a lay of the land more specifically in Colorado? So is the Polis administration, for those who are unfamiliar, very hostile to conservationists? How about the Parks and Wildlife Commission? Because certain states, as listeners know, are starting to kind of be taken over by preservationists or rewilders. So give kind of a lay of the land, because everyone knows Colorado has lots of hunters. I think the largest elk population in the whole country is in Colorado. You guys were center stage for forced wolf reintroduction efforts recently by ballot box initiative, even though narrowly. That's going to have a lot of consequences. So what is happening specifically in Colorado? Are people who lead Colorado in endorsement of these type of policies?
Well, our current governor is, and I want to clarify something. You said not supportive of a conservationist type agenda or landscape. It depends on who you look at and what side of the fence you look at, because the animal rights extremists have now coined the term conservation. They've also coined the term, you know, that they are conservationist. And now you see some of the rhetoric that has flown over to the newspapers. So they're actually capturing and in my mind, capitalizing on our efforts intentionally, while the general public sits back and thinks that, well, maybe these are the conservationists. And so Governor Polis has been very astute in making sure that his and his husband's, the first gentleman, Marlon Reese's, wishes, wants, and desires were easily accomplished and attainable. And some of that came from, I think, Governor Polis himself, but a lot of it, I believe, came from the first gentleman, Marlon Reese. And you can see that by appointments to different commissions and boards and committees. You can see that by a change in the landscape, the oversight, or the thumb pushing on specific agencies, including the Department of Agriculture, the Department of Natural Resources, and Colorado Parks and Wildlife. And while there might be skepticism to some of that, and it's not a tinfoil hat and it's not a Black Hawk helicopter conspiracy theory, you can look at the people that are actually put in those positions and the objectives and the agendas that they try to implement and initiate. You look at the Colorado General Assembly and the legislature that we have, which is more democratically favored than it is Republican or independently favored. And a lot of the notions that come out of that and the Parks and Wildlife Commission come directly from the Department of Natural Resources, which then Governor Polis has a significant amount of influence on. I mean, they all work for him. And the first gentleman, Marlon Reese, sits on many different committees or has very good connections with individuals of a lot of these organizations that are not animal welfare, they're animal rights. And if I really believe if they could have it all, they would turn around and take hunting and fishing out of the picture if there was a way, shape, or form that it would help them accomplish their entire goal, which is to make sure that the North American model of wildlife conservation and science-based wildlife management does not guide our wildlife practices and our wildlife management procedures. And the criteria that we have to live with is, you know, it's science-based. I mean, what we've done over the last 125 years is factual, and people's perceptions and wants, wishes, and desires a lot of times don't fall into that. But the landscape that we have, and you know, I gave this analogy to a guy about 2 weeks ago. He said, well, on a scale of 1 to 10, where do you consider Colorado's wildlife management? And I said, wildlife management, an 8. He said, well, I thought it'd be less than that. And I said, politics within wildlife management, a 1, and with 10 being the best. And so I believe that our agency is doing the yeoman's work on science, and I believe that the, and there's facts to prove this, it's not my assumption, that the particular administration that we have to deal with would like to have nothing other than to take the funding mechanism out, to continue to put apex predators on the landscape or pedestalize them with no management whatsoever and create this diabolical toilet bowl to where, you know, when you flush, everything goes down, and the sportsmen and women are the first ones to probably feel the brunt of that. And I think it's their agenda to try to accomplish that in the shortest amount of period of time that they possibly can.
I have heard that the first gentleman of Colorado has been very influential. I think even more influential than any spouse I've ever heard of any governor. I've never heard of spouses in Virginia being on, let's say, commissions, so to speak, let's say wildlife decisions. That seems unheard of because you'd have to divorce yourself from that. I feel like that would be too much of a conflict of interest, but that's interesting. At least he's trying to gesture there. But you were alluding to commissioners, and I had seen the news recently that yourself, your organization, Hall for Wildlife, and others have been really active in forcing the legislature to reconsider a couple nominees to go on the Colorado Parks and Wildlife Commission. What has been happening with that?
Well, for quite some time, the governor has been able to appoint individuals to the commission. Granted, he was elected in 2018. So since then, he's been appropriately posturing and maneuvering his plans to put certain people into certain places. And the three current ones that we had that were up for appointment after, well, for confirmation after they were appointed last year, they have to be confirmed by the Senate. So they have to wait until a legislative session starts. So they were appointed last July, and they went through the process of making decisions on the best possible, you know, attempts that they possibly could. And they were up for confirmation for the month of, well, I guess the first part and the latter part of February and first part of March of this year. All three of those were by a lot of different groups, a lot of different sectors in the community, were not deemed to be appropriately appointed because of their representation or the lack thereof. And I say all three, the mountain bike community, the power sports community, the agriculture community, the sportsman community, all of them came out in opposition during the Senate Agriculture Committee hearing several weeks ago. Two of the three were not favorably recommended to the full Senate vote. That was Commissioner Gary Skiba and Commissioner Jess Bouillot. Commissioner Jack Murphy had a favorable recommendation. And so there was an attempt to try to create some further distractions from what I would consider supporters of those individuals. And those other communities that I previously mentioned, they came out in opposition, even at a harder line. And so you started to see this giant email campaign come in from different sectors and people lobbying their legislators, their senators. And last week, Commissioner Gary Skiba withdrew his nomination because of intense scrutiny and for a variety of other reasons, likely, that he withdrew his nomination. And they were supposed to have a vote on the floor last Thursday, which then was subsequently postponed till Friday, which now has subsequently been postponed till tomorrow. And we hear that there might be another postponement until even Thursday. And ironically, this week we've got a commission meeting, which Jess Buyo and Jack Murphy are supposed to attend. But if you go back a couple years, there's been consternation or criticism over multiple appointments to this commission that while it is supposed to be a Parks and Wildlife Commission, and there is criteria to meet those individual positions within the commission, the concept has been that they would kind of do what they want, and a lot of different groups would gripe and complain and moan and groan about what they were doing. And to give you an example, one of the commissioners, Commissioner Jay Touchton, who's a nice guy, but he used to be an attorney for Wild Earth Guardians and the Humane Society of the United States, and he's sitting there with sportsmen and women dollars and parks and recreation dollars making decisions based upon his expertise, which comes from an animal rights background. Commissioner Rich Reading runs the Butterfly Pavilion, and he has more of a environmentalist versus conservationist component. He's not necessarily, at least he hasn't alluded to that he's anti-hunting, but it appears that he is definitely pro-large carnivore and a lack of management of large carnivores. The nuances that you get into this political landscape that you talked about earlier, Gabby, is his wife, Rich Reading's wife, was appointed to sit on the Colorado Habitat Stamp Committee, appointed by the governor, confirmed by the Senate. I was on that committee for 8 years. It's a conservation program that sportsmen and women have been working with to the tune of about $9 to $11 million a year. I sat as the chair of that committee. I was appointed under Governor Hickenlooper and subsequently under the current Governor Polis. I have to say I didn't vote for either one of them, but his wife was put on there, and she's a sitting member of the Defenders of Wildlife. And she was put on a sportsman oriented committee to take sportsmen and women dollars to do different things with that money. So you've got crossover at multiple levels. And I would like to mention that Commissioner Jay Touchton, the animal rights attorney for Wild Earth Guardians and HSUS, his wife or his better half, or maybe it's his partner, I'm not sure what they would classify, she works, to the best of my knowledge, as the personal wildlife policy advisor to the governor. And so she's really good friends with Marlon Reese, the first gentleman. And then you look at other commission appointments or other people on different boards and committees, and you can see the formulation of this spider web, this network that has been created to make sure that this hand knows what that hand is doing and that that hand is very cognizant of what the other hand is doing. And pretty soon you got all the hands in the same pot. And while those particular individuals would gripe and complain about sportsmen being overrepresented on parks and wildlife commissions throughout the country, I strongly believe that there needs to be a revamping of the process because of these agenda-driven tactics that we start to see at different levels, Washington, Oregon, California, Colorado, you name it. And the governor has fully taken advantage of what has been available to him. The first gentleman has fully taken advantage of what he's been allowed to do. And if you can look at the boards and committees and appointments of different positions, elected or otherwise, you can see that this is a strong attempt to derobe and disembowel the North American model and science-based wildlife management and consumptive use from hunters and anglers. Long explanation, but it's a long drawn out process.
I thought it was articulated very well. And actually we see other states respond to the actions of Colorado and other Western states. I don't know if you're aware, Tennessee has actually been kind of deliberating a bill to strengthen the criteria for wildlife commissioners. So I thought that was really refreshing to see that you actually have to be engaged in these activities to be considered for nomination to the commission or to their, I think their wildlife resources board or one of those kind of derivatives there. So states are actually responding quite affirmatively, kind of against what Colorado is doing to prevent this type of, let's say, mess from kind of happening in their respective states or capitals as well. So we do see kind of the opposite happening too, with this reactionary behavior kind of happening in Colorado, we see states that are more friendly to sportsmen try to take preemptive measures to prevent that from happening.
Yeah, and I wish we would have been more preemptive years ago. When Governor Hickenlooper was here, we used to have a Colorado Division of Wildlife and a Colorado Parks Department. And because of cost-saving measures or ideologies about how to turn around and streamline state government, which often becomes more of a debacle, in my opinion, than what benefit it provides, he merged the parks and the wildlife side to take it out of the Division of Wildlife logo and put it into the Colorado Parks and Wildlife logo. And that's when they merged the Parks Board along with the Wildlife Board. And while I don't think that that was a good idea, and we've had to deal with the repercussions or ramifications of that since then, I do want to preface that statement with anybody who has paid attention knows the facts, but the ones that haven't paid attention and maybe as well as what they should have, Parks and Wildlife was merged, but the checking accounts were not. The money that was expended on the wildlife side goes to the wildlife side. And while they might share buildings and they might share logos and they might share, you know, some sort of administrative oversight, they have separate checking accounts. And because of Pittman Robertson and Dingell Johnson funds that come from the federal excise side of things, that money can't be convoluted into a parks component unless it has to do with wildlife, fish and wildlife issues. And so while the guys wear the same logos and the same insignias, we have wildlife officers and we have wildlife side of the agency and we have parks side of the agency. And while they might work hand in hand, they don't share each other's checkbooks. And so the agency was not put together to bail one out over the other. It was put together to hopefully streamline, which I don't think that it did. And I actually think that it caused more of a cluster than what most people realize. But it's worth mentioning that strategy because I think it could be done appropriately in some land of nirvana or utopia, but we didn't have that. And we didn't end up with that. And then when you turn around and get a animal activist regime, an extremist regime to bring in top of what we originally had, I think it only deepens the divide and deepens the consternation that you see from a wildlife management side of agency to a parks and recreation side that very seldom pays its own way. And it damn sure doesn't when it gets out of the state parks program. You know, outdoor recreation, to the best of my knowledge, and I sit on a lot of boards and committees, has not paid its fair share, let alone helped on the conservation efforts like what they would like to think that they do just because they pay taxes on the landscape of you know, their homeowners' taxes or their vehicle taxes or their income taxes or whatever. That money doesn't go to conservation efforts, and it damn sure doesn't go to parks and wildlife efforts either.
And we actually saw a diminishment. I don't know what state saw fewer hunters and anglers, but there was a decrease in $300 million allotted to the states under PR Dingell Johnson this past year. And I scratched my head and wonder why. I don't think it was exclusively Colorado, but it had to be a multitude of states, maybe states that had enacted certain policies or prohibited certain forms of hunting. So I'm going to go back and see if that's the case. But more, I would say importantly, Dan, it is that you guys are having to wrestle with two ballot initiatives this year relating to wildcats or bobcats, mountain lions. So could you briefly explain what those two initiatives are and why the organization is concerned about them potentially going before the voters or potentially being implemented?
Just to bring it back to current day, we've got one big game cat initiative that we're dealing with. Initiative 101 was actually withdrawn. So we've got initiative 91 at this point in time that we're dealing with. And that's to prohibit the hunting of mountain lions and bobcats in the state of Colorado. And it also says lynx, but lynx are federally and state protected in the lower 48, so they can't be harvested anyway. But we did have two at one time. We did fight through the proper channels of the Secretary of State, Supreme Court, the title board process, and we forced our opposition, a group called Cats Aren't Trophies, their acronym is CATS, we forced them to withdraw the 101 initiative. And we changed the language. We were successful in changing the language to the Supreme Court and the title board on the first initiative, which is 91. I do want to make sure that I recognize, and I'd be remiss if I didn't say it, the initiative that we have now is 91, but that will not be the final initiative that is on the ballot. So if anybody starts referencing things, we would prefer that they reference the Colorado hunting ban or the big cat ban or whatever, but the number will change if the opponents or proponents of the measures, our opponents, get signatures to get it on the ballot, which they're in the process of gathering now, then it will be on the ballot and be renumbered to where there's an actual ballot. That's just a clarification of what we're dealing with. But it is to prohibit the harvest of mountain lions and bobcats. And while they call it a trophy hunting ban, Gabby, it's a hunting ban. Their definition of trophy hunting in the measure, which we got taken out of the title, so the voter won't see trophy hunting in there. They'll see it just as a hunting ban, even though the trophy hunting is still in the measure itself in the overall statutory language that will be enacted if this was to pass. But the definition of trophy hunting is to intentionally kill, wound, stalk, pursue, or entrap a bobcat or a mountain lion. Intentionally kill, wound, and I joke about this. I don't know anybody that goes out and intentionally tries to wound anything. But intentionally kill, pursue, stalk, or entrap a bobcat or a mountain lion. That is hunting. And the thing that should be concerning to people is that the way that this is written, it won't be regulatory, it'll be statutory. And a precedent could be set not only within our state, but other Western states and throughout the United States for that matter, that if anybody wants to utilize similar language, they can capitalize on the inefficiencies or ineffectiveness of what we wouldn't have been able to accomplish by allowing this measure to move forward and not defeat it. Statutory reference can be made to a variety of different things. And essentially, you could take bobcats and mountain lions out of this. You could put bighorn sheep. You could put black bears. You could put mallard ducks. You could put alligators. You could put turkeys in it if you really wanted to. Just because of what it says in the definition of trophy hunting. Intentionally killing, wounding, stalking, pursuing, or entrapping. Some other components of this that people don't necessarily read into because it doesn't say it in the title, but it says it in the measure. It talks about electronic collars or e-tracking devices or training devices for the use of hounds in this specific circumstance. But the way it's worded, because it'll be statutory, you could incorporate that into upland game bird dogs, waterfowl dogs, coon dogs, rabbit dogs, maybe cattle dogs for that matter, if you decided to utilize that. Those are things that start to bring this to a level of uncertainty for other people that go, well, I don't hunt mountain lions. Well, I don't want to trap a bobcat, even though with what we can use in the state of Colorado is cage traps. We can't use any of the other traditional methods of take because that was banned in 96. But they go, I don't have any intention on doing that. And then you have them read those other subsets or those paragraphs, and they go, wait a minute, I hunt pheasants. I use tracking devices or collars on my dogs, training collars. Are you saying that I couldn't do that? Well, they're not attacking it in this specific initiative, but it will be written into this specific initiative to where somebody needs to really pay close attention and look at the intentions of our opposition. And they said this in the title board hearing. When brought up about the electronic collars, their attorney said, well, we don't think that dogs should be utilized for any pursuit of game. Just like they said on the lynx side of things, when they asked, why did you put lynx in there if they're already federally protected? And their answer was, in case they're ever delisted, we don't want them to ever be harvested. People need to look at farther down the road, the objectives of what these groups are trying to create. And if they can get through the door, find a chink in the armor, get through the first line of defense, which right now is the trappers and lion hunters, they get through us. Where are they going to go if they've already talked about upland bird dogs or electronic collars? Where are they going to go if they've already redefined trophy, where it's just actually hunting? And I think that's where everybody in the country needs to pay deep, dark attention to what is going on in Colorado, because it'll be the first time that a definition of trophy hunting has been established, to the best of our knowledge. We've got wanton waste laws. We've got poaching laws and so forth. This is the definition of trophy hunting, which doesn't have a damn thing to do with trophy. It has to do with hunting, period.
Judging by the verbiage you laid out, that would be most likely the case. And that's actually a scary possibility that this would even have national implications where other states or interests could roll with that statutory language and say, oh, you know what? We can use the same here. And then pursue wider prohibitions, because it doesn't just stop at these apex predators. We've seen all across the country, they have desires to, you know, go after low hanging fruit as well. They could say duck hunting is cruel and unusual under these same terms. So we shouldn't put it past them to want to try to prohibit hunting writ large, because we have seen them make gestures like this. And then some people among our ranks are like, well, no, you know, it's just these kind of like archaic forms, like you said, of kind of one you're interested in, you know, trapping. And I think it's horrible what an unfair shake that trapping has gotten. Although people have now leaned on trappers here in the eastern United States for trying to combat, you know, predators who are going after turkey poults and whatnot. So we see a resurgence of trapping, I think, starting to be utilized again. But they don't see that there, maybe it's not their favorite form of hunting, but some other form of hunting adjacent, or maybe their preferred form of hunting, could eventually be targeted. So we have to get our fellow hunters and conservationists in that same mind frame. But they're a little stubborn, so we have to work on them. Dan, as we conclude our talk together, where would you like to direct my listeners to get involved, learn more about all of your efforts? Please list all those appropriate links if you can.
Well, if you wouldn't mind, I'd like to mention one other thing, because at the beginning of this, you mentioned a couple different initiatives that we've got, and there's actually two in the Denver City County ballot side of things, and one is a fur ban, and there's just to show the hypocrisy of our enemies on the landscape. It's called a Denver fur ban. And people say, oh, that must be fur coats. The way it's written, just like the confusing components of what this measure is that I mentioned about the bobcat and the mountain lions, the fur ban mentions wild animal fiber. So beaver felt cowboy hats, fly fishing lures, regular fishing lures, Native American art and accoutrements, like with our Denver March Indian powwow and the Native American cultures that we deal with. Then there's a slaughterhouse ban as well. They want to ban the slaughterhouse, the one lamb slaughterhouse, largest in the Western United States. The reason I bring those up is because it goes into the same mentality of our state government and the ideologies of our general legislature and where some of those things come out. We've got a coexistence bill that's going through the legislature as we speak. That coexistence bill has to do with us actually not consuming stuff to be able to not consume it. And so this is not a one-off with the bobcat and the mountain lion deal. And I would urge people, if they're really interested to what is going on, they can go to SaveTheHuntColorado.com. That's our website. They can donate on there. They can get educated on there. They can see some of our videos that we've actually produced. We've got Instagram with CRWM. We've got Facebook for the old guys like me, which is Coloradans for Responsible Wildlife Management. And there's another issues committee that we actually created called Colorado Wildlife Deserve Better. And there's a website to that effect called Wildlife Deserve Better. But if they want the up-to-date, easy-to-find stuff, SaveTheHuntColorado.com is the best place to be able to go. And the thing that I would say in closing, pay attention not only to what's going on in the West and see what agenda-driven mentalities are trying to take place, but pay attention to the Midwest. Pay attention to the East. Because these things surface somewhere other than the place that they actually grab some feet and get some hold. And I would encourage each and every person that's listening to this and any other podcast or media, pay attention to your local parks and wildlife commissions or your game commissions. Pay attention to your general assembly and your legislature, because this stuff didn't start in one place. It's broadened way, way out. And we need to figure out a way to plant our flag if you really want to support the North American model, science-based management, and if we want to continue to manage our wildlife populations in sustainable levels in perpetuity.
Well said. Thank you, Dan. Thanks for listening to District of Conservation. If you enjoyed what you heard today, go leave us some reviews on Apple and Spotify or wherever podcasts are played. Your feedback will help us reach more people, and I love to know what is on your mind after each episode. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter to never miss a beat or a guest announcement, because that is our way of updating all of you listeners. And we have just hit 1,000 followers on Instagram for the podcast account. Thank you very much. And if you have any guest suggestions or topics you want to hear on the show, I am all ears. I would love to hear your feedback there. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned for the next episode.